Welcome to the Savage Geese Podcast. Today's sponsors are Johnny's Hot Dogs. Stick it in a bun, put on some toppings, and jam it down your gullet.
Yeah, wow. Well, I'm excited.
I am excited as hell to have you here. I have, let's just put it this way. I got a guy that I met. He's from Kelly Blue Book. His name's Micah. And this guy changed my life as soon as I met him at a press event. So I'm going to let you do the introduction. Tell me a little bit and the listeners about your life and you.
Yeah. Well, no, item one, there's another guy, Mike, named Mikey at Kelly Blue Book that changed your life. Cause that guy sounds awesome. I want to meet him. yeah. You know what? Like, I will say that, I've been doing this job at Kelly Blue Book for more than 12 years now. And I've met a zillion people, doing this kind of work, you know, driving new cars and that kind of thing. And, like every once in a while, you meet a lot of people, the same kind of people, and we're like, hey, this person's kind of my part of my tribe. This feels like the right kind of dude. And you're one of those guys. So with all that glad handing out of the way, some quick background on me. Maybe I'll start with the fun stuff. I never went to college, so I'm an uneducated man. I started as a janitor, and then I kind of crawled my way up through janitorial into being a maintenance man, which was sweet. And then through radio is my first introduction into the world of media. So I moved into a radio position just as a board operator, which is kind of a low-level radio gig. And then eventually I worked on an automotive radio program. And then that automotive radio program moved into doing automotive promotional, like in marketing videos. And then that moved into eventually working at Kelly Blue Book. And so I've been here for, a little more than 12 years now. And I drive new cars. I occasionally travel and I make videos. I'm the managing editor of video here, and it's a pretty sweet gig.
I had no idea that was your background. How do you feel about where you transitioned from, the janitor stuff aside, but from where you went to where you're at now, dealing with the cars and kind of the social media aspect, which I am assuming really wasn't that big of a deal when you first started this?
Yeah, man, I've been doing this long enough that social media didn't really exist in a meaningful way when I started at Kelly Blue Book. And what's interesting is that they had the forethought to dive into video, I think, pretty early in the game. For a 90 plus year old company, Kelly Blue Book has these moments along the way where they have really great vision, like putting pricing online. It's like, oh, that was a pretty great move. Now that books aren't really a thing. It's funny because at some point, I've said for years, at some point Kelly Blue Book is just going to go to KBB, kind of like Kentucky Fried Chicken became KFC.
Yeah.
Because books are so passe. But it's been such a massive transition from when I started doing this, not the least of which being how we were making videos. So for me, video is something that I didn't really seek, but those were the opportunities that were presented to me. So it's become my specialty, and I have a lot of thoughts about it. But one of them is that when we first started doing videos at Kelly Blue Book, way back in the day, I was a younger man. I had a goofball goatee and I was much heavier. So if you want to see some embarrassing videos of me, just dig it deep into the KBB archive and you'll find some fun stuff. But back in the day, we did stuff a lot like Motor Week, you know, where it's like you got B-roll of a dude adjusting a seat and you got a VO happening. And then over time, I started doing more of character driven, a little bit more esoteric, a little more freeform kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, well, that's kind of some cute stuff that you're doing there. You do that, and then we'll do these serious videos. And then eventually, over time, there was a realization within the company that, why don't we just make all of our videos that other kind of video that you're doing? So I guess one of the great joys in working in Kelly Blue Book is that I've been able to shape what we do video wise and sort of without much scrutiny, because our organization is really about numbers. So the company I work for doesn't really understand video or editorial content, but they know that we are having some success with it. So they just leave me be. And being able to develop that video stuff over such a long period of time and have that freedom has been kind of amazing.
So I think if you've never seen his videos before, he does videos on Kelly Blue Book, and also you started your own channel now. Is that that's right? Correct? Or
Another one of those KBB having forethought things. I came to them with this idea that I wanted to do longer form video content with my own channel, specifically doing reviews with my wife and daughter as well. And they're like, okay. I was like, okay, great. I'm so glad the company has that kind of vision that I can do something that is not strictly within the corporate confines, and that it can still be a complementary element to what I do at KBB.
And that's great because a lot of times corporate roles and corporate media specifically can be very, very fickle and rigid about what you can and can't do. And you have to align with their values 1,000%. And the fact that you can be yourself, the first part of it. And then the other part is you can go out on your own and be yourself and do your own thing without them really being in your way is great.
Yeah, the specialness of that arrangement is not lost on me. So yeah, I feel really lucky to be with Kelly Blue Book. Again, it's yeah, I years ago, I remember my the guy who hired me here describing Kelly Blue Book as being viewed almost like a quasi-governmental agency. That's kind of how people think of it, and it's like that's not completely unjustified, but it's interesting that within that corporate structure, they're like, yeah, okay, you do you. All right. Happy to.
Well, the last thing that I was going to bring up is the first time I met you, we talked about you were asking me about stuff with the YouTube channel and like video in general. And I kind of said, like I meet enough people now to know when somebody has something and somebody doesn't. And I noticed with you, we're not at all alike with our video presentation, but you bring a real personality to your video, a real like good pace, a really strong energy that's captivating to a lot of people. And you help to sell the videos. So you can just, you were asking me, like, what do you do? I'm like, just be yourself because just yourself in the videos is enough to capture a lot of attention. So I think that's really strong that you're able to just do that, be you without having to fake it much. And it's got to be a lot easier for you to do that. Am I wrong in saying that?
Yeah, the ability to be yourself on camera is a weird special skill that I've only through experience noted not many people have. It's you can have a conversation with somebody that's like they're really personable and engaging, and then when the red light comes on the camera, people become different things because they're really aware. So this idea of like kind of being comfortable with who I am on camera is something I think I had a little bit of an innate ability, but I've also really had to develop. And the other thing I was going to say is that one thing about video in the automotive space is that there are so many paths to success that I think it's a real mistake to look at what somebody's doing as successful and think, I need to copy that. Because you're right, you and I have kind of very different aesthetics and approaches, but there's value in both of those. And to me, so this is the thing I'm really enjoying right now. When I first started, it was all Buff books. So it's like Kelly Blue Book's there, and then you got, your Car and Driver and your Motor Trend, and you got, all these like kind of names, these organizations, right? And over the past few years, it's all shifted. It's not names anymore, it's people.
Right.
So for me, I'm really connecting with these entrepreneurial spirits who are like, I'm gonna have a YouTube channel and I'm gonna do this, bootstrap this by myself. And for me, like, it's really neat because I'm like, I kind of relate more to those people than to the people who work for the books and the names, which is funny because I'm very much a Kelly Blue Book guy, but I feel like a much stronger kinship with like you guys and you and the Straight Pipes.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I understand it. And I think the way that media is transitioning, at least in this sector, generationally, we were used to just, okay, you have network TV, you have cable TV or satellite TV, whatever. And that was your primary source of information. And now with really having a video platform, a strong alternative video platform, which is very much corporate still, the fact that you can be independent, you can be a strong independent media outlet, and compete with it. And that's the strange part. The big media outlets don't have as much pull as they used to, largely because of the overhead involved with running that. You know, we talked about Motor Trend. Like, well, why does it cost them $100,000 to produce a head-to-head video? You know, like me and I've talked about the straight pipes with this. Are you kidding me? I'm like, we could throw together a video like that for 1/10 the price, but we don't have the overhead. We don't have an editor. We don't have a lighting guy, a sound guy, a camera car guy. You know, like, you cut back a lot of this stuff, and we're very much more mobile and able to get a lot more done with a lot less. And I think that's where you're starting to see the transition. And people like the variety of it. You know, there's a downfall to that too, because, you know, there's a lot of copycatting, of course. And the originality starts to get affected because there's only so much you can do with car videos. I mean, there's really only so much you can do. So it becomes very personality based, entertainment based, or educational. In your case, you really have a good, you got the personality, you got some of the education part, and you got some of the entertainment part down. And that's why I think you're going to be very successful at what you do as well.
You know what I figured out though? So there are people who are encyclopedic with their automotive knowledge. I mean, I think you dig into things with a depth that I couldn't approach. Like I saw one of your live streams, and you know, people are kind of throwing just random stuff. I'm like, I don't know how I would answer that. Like, honestly, I have to like dig and kind of figure out what it is I'm going to do. So that's not who I am. Why would I try to be that? You're that. You do that really well. Like, let you be that expert. What can I do that's different? And I've kind of found that I'm much more of an experiential guy. Like, put me in a situation or give me an experience, and then let me relate that experience. And it's like, I think that's where I'm going to be. And I don't feel a pressure at this point in my career to try and pretend to be something I'm not. So for me, I think what's cool is that YouTube really gives a lot of different voices the opportunity to be heard. The other thing, your point about like, there's only so many things you can do with cars. I get that. Back, so when in 2008, I think, so I was really fresh to KBB back then. I had a Lotus Elise, and I did a video just driving around LA or doing something. And I remember my boss at the time, he said like, you know, that's good, but I mean, how many of these can you do? And I've literally made hundreds of videos, actually maybe thousands of videos since then, and we're still doing it. So like, we're still finding innovative, interesting ways to do this stuff. And to me, that becomes the game, right? Like, we've done this a zillion times before. What can we find that's going to keep this interesting for me? And so there's always some other new, you know, horizon to explore. And I think that's what I love so much about this.
Yeah. And I think I meant it more in the terms of the more saturation you get and you see new video channels popping up all the time. They're like, okay, this guy's copying, you know, it kind of started with Saab Kyle, you know, his walk around technique of let's take a look at the car for 30 minutes and go over every detail, you know, and then you got people copying that. And then you have people copying the vlog. And I mean, I feel like we're at a point where, well, what else can you do? Because if you're doing press cars, there's only so much you can really do with those anyway. Yeah. You know, I mean, you have to return them in one piece. So it's like, what's the next thing? Like, what can you do next that brings more value or information or entertainment? And I guess you're right. That's kind of the fun of it, to come up with the magic every new video, or you don't have to. Some people just don't ever change their style. They don't, you know, like it's the same thing over and over again. But from a creative perspective, I think that's part of the fun for me, is coming up, the challenge of that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and just one quick thought. I started Micah Drives. Well, Micah Musio is the channel, because they do more than drive. They fly and do motorcycle stuff as well. But on that, if you look at the first video I put up, which was back in, I guess, February of 2019, to the one we just put up yesterday. So, you know, just a couple months span, they are radically different. And that ability to kind of quickly iterate and evolve and figure out like, nope, that doesn't work. I don't like doing that. I need more structure. I need less this. That ability to kind of like quickly update and change, I think, is what's super exciting about, you know, doing video on YouTube. So,
yeah, that's a really good point. I think the only thing I'll bring up with that is the only risk with the social space with YouTube. I mean, if you cut your Kelly Blue Book job out of the factor and you are solo artist on YouTube, there's some considerations people don't really understand with it. And I think that is, look, you're surviving whether people like it or not, off of ad revenue. And that doesn't mean that you're bought and sold. It's just very, very hard to live off of making videos. And some people get bent out of shape, like, oh, why do you have three ads in a video? I'm like, look, dude, this is free content that you're getting. You're not having to pay for it, and you have to wait through an ad or click on an ad. That's the whole reason this exists, or like crowdfunding. So it's a very different industry. And obviously we don't pick the ads either. It's interest-based ads that Google picks for you, based on all the tracking that's being done on your whole life. But, you know, it is hard because people do get upset. You know, everybody wants something for nothing or free, but I think most of the viewers really appreciate the fact that, you know, we're kind of standalone from everything else. It feels more real, I think, is the point.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, I was shocked. We finally monetized Kelly Blue Book's YouTube channel after years of me suggesting it was a good idea and then hearing it's not worth the effort. So we finally monetized it. And like I was like, I am ready for a deluge of years, and it never happened. Like, and granted, we're only doing like a pre-roll right now.
Yeah.
Like mid-roll ads. But I fully expected, you know, we'd, you know, upset the locals, and nobody noticed. Nobody seemed to care. So hopefully there's some understanding that, yeah, if you want to see these free videos, the people making them have to make some money too.
Yeah. And I think most people are used to the ads now. I hate them. I've always hated them. But I grew up, you know, we grew up with TV where you know, like you were inundated with advertisements all the time. It just, you're constantly being sold something. And that's what's always annoyed me. Like, hey, I want to watch a 2-minute video. Why do I got to sit through like a 30-second ad for some, like, you know, little information? Like a short video drives me crazy. But if I'm watching a longer form video, it's a lot more easy to digest. But I mean, I'm surprised Kelly Blue Book took that long to monetize their videos.
Well, actually, it makes a lot of sense because Kelly Blue Book, their business is much, much bigger than what I'm doing in editorial. And like what we make from YouTube is so overcast, is so overshadowed by everything else we do. That's what's funny about working here is that I'm on like editorial island off in a corner. And then in the editorial team, video is a much, much smaller. It's literally just been me, maybe one other person, and then vendors that help shoot and edit our stuff. I oversee all that stuff, so I've had like a lot of free reign, but I'm just one dude in a huge organization that's owned by a much huger organization that's also owned by a mothership above that. So there's this huge corporate thing happening, and I'm just like one guy. So like what we're making with YouTube money is like, oh, well, that's fine, whatever.
Okay, so now it's time to get into the Patreon questions. So you've been in the industry for a long time. Has your interest in vehicles increased or decreased, and in which direction?
I would say it has changed. When I started, I was very much an enthusiast. And at this point, I'm not so much an enthusiast because I've kind of done a lot of the things I wanted to do a lot of times. So I've kind of worn out those pleasure receptors. I don't marvel when I see like new cars, but I really, I think I've shifted to really appreciating cars that bring huge value to normal people. Like I really love smart, high value, high volume vehicles. So I would much rather do, and I'm not joking, I would much rather do a minivan review than a supercar review. Supercar reviews are for me one note. Yeah, it's fast and we're marveling at it, but there's so much nuance in a minivan review. So that's kind of where I am now.
Okay, so what is your favorite car that you've seen recently for under $50,000 in all this time?
Ooh, under $50,000. You know what? I was having a conversation earlier, and I was talking with somebody about the Toyota Corolla hatchback. And I don't know why. Maybe it's irrational, but I really like that car because it looks outrageous. Me, my automotive foundation was forged in the 90s when import tuning was a really big deal. And to me, when you look at that Toyota Corolla hatchback, especially in that blue flame paint, that would have like won awards at Hot Import Nights. And the fact that it's like very inexpensive, drives pretty great, looks wild, a ton of safety equipment. I really, really dig that. That's probably not the answer anybody was asking for. So maybe I'll just change it up and say I was driving a Honda Civic Type R yesterday, and that thing for $150,000 is a ton of fun. No, wait. Sorry, I'm gonna change my answer. Changing my answer. I drove a Dodge Challenger last year during a performance car comparison, and just V8 power, rear drive, and all that weight, it was so stupid fun to drive, like, get drifty with it. I was like, I think I actually might need to buy one of these and make it a drift car. So I guess that's privilege coming through because I drive a lot of different stuff and I can't give you a straight answer.
So Civic Type R right now and like a Challenger, like a 392 or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, that 392, a Challenger would be just kind of a good dumb bit of fun, and I think that's what I need in my life.
Okay, so you answered two questions. Well, kind of. I guess I'll re-ask it. What's your favorite car you've driven in the past 5 years? I guess
Past
price is
5 years,
no. Yeah.
yeah. If we're taking price out of the equation, I'm going to say Raptor. Some of the best moments of my life have been captured on film driving Raptors.
Okay.
So, I mean, to me, there's nothing like it. That thing is so stupid capable. It tells you something about its abilities. When I, who live in a suburban environment, where a big ass truck that's much wider than the normal truck would make zero sense, still want a Raptor. So, yeah, Raptor all day.
All right. So since I don't know if some of these questions are directed towards just you or I, I'll just put mine out there just in case somebody wants to know. I'd
Yeah.
say my favorite cars I've driven in the past 5 years are three of them: the Lexus LC 500, the Porsche GT3 RS, and the Ariel Atom for by a stretch.
By the way, I would have said Ariel Atom if I'd ever driven an Ariel Atom.
No, I'm sure once I see you in the flesh again, we'll go pounding around.
We gotta
Yeah.
nail that down, man. I need to come to Illinois and drive that damn Adam. That thing's so sweet. I have had a love affair with that thing for years. So
Oh, you'll love it. I mean, if you had a Lotus, you're gonna, I mean, it makes sense. It's like the logical evolution of the track day car, maxed out to 10.
so cool.
So let's go to the next question. Thoughts on Cadillac and why they seem not to know what they are doing?
You know, I mean, if I had one quick off-the-cuff thought, it would just be leadership churn. That might be one of the big issues that there's. The stuff that's coming out right now is the result of decisions made years ago. So I think it's going to take them a little while to figure out. I think their big issue, though, is style. Like when you're putting out brand new cars where people are like, I think that's ugly, you've made a terrible move, especially in a category where desirability is kind of all that matters. That and brand loyalty.
Yeah. That's a good answer. I would pretty much mirror what you said. And I think, from the people I've talked to in GM, it is definitely leadership. It's the people who are running it and then the stubbornness not to let certain things go more than anything. Like the Buick stuff and the Cadillac problems are the same. You have two brands that aren't particularly relevant anymore and they don't know what to do to reinvigorate them. And the people that used to buy them are no longer really buying them anymore. And it just may be time to move on from them and put your money elsewhere or reinvent it, create another brand to make up for the fact that nobody cares about most of those products anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I kind of lamented the fact that they had to kill Pontiac because I feel like that was a brand that had a ton of potential. But yeah, it's kind of like the Harley dilemma. You know, what do you do with all the boomers once they're gone? Like, who's going to replace those people? I don't know. Not me.
Well, that's something for, again, executive and PR and marketing to figure out, what's relevant and where to go from there. And I think they don't know, clearly. I mean, if you look at their marketing, GM's marketing is one of the most mind-boggling of any brand, but that's for another discussion.
Yeah.
Michael asks, with many used car price guides, how do the different guides compare, and which one would be most accurate?
So this is one of those questions that's a little bit outside of my sphere of expertise because I'm an editorial guy at a company that does a lot of stuff with pricing guides. So I'm not going to even give you an answer because you're expecting me to say Kelly Blue Book. And so even if I said it was or wasn't, I'm biased. But I do know that you know, Kelly Blue Book has access to enormous amounts of data. They use real transactions, both wholesale and retail. And, you know, by being connected with Manheim, there's a lot of data there to help guide our prices. And then I also know that there's like a wing of the company. You know, you walk through the company here and it's like, I don't know what you people do, but there's a lot of you. And there's one of those hunks, a big mass of humanity. And all they do is figure out the numbers. And in fact, too, to help support those numbers, they, you know, they drive vehicles. So they kind of have their own assessments. So if you can use the validity of the numbers by the resources going into making them, I think it makes a strong case for Kelly Blue Book. But again, I'm totally biased.
And yeah, it makes sense. I mean, that's almost a loaded question. I mean, I could put my 2 cents in there, and I know probably half as much as you from experience. Most every single dealer network will use Black Book, but that's skewed mm-hmm. towards wholesale, which is not consumer friendly ever. So, totally. I mean, you know, Kelly Blue Book has done a good job always ever since I've been old enough to read. It is a very consumer friendly type basis for people to make a decent judgment. I mean, I think if you're a consumer and you're looking to find the best price, like how to find the price of your car, you really want to look at Kelly Blue Book kind of first, and then NADA as a backup. And then if you have access to somebody that has a Black Book account or a wholesaler that can look it up, between those three and that data, you can generally find what your car's worth if that's what you're looking for from a consumer perspective. But almost always Kelly Blue Book's so good now, like you said, like there's so much analytics and data that they're researching, that between the price spread of like, hey, trade in versus like excellent, you're always getting a pretty accurate number.
Yeah.
What is your take on Carfax and AutoCheck? Their systems seem to be inaccurate, misleading, and there's no way to really dispute things. Why is it so trusted?
Yeah, again, that's kind of a little bit outside of my sphere, but I think when you have a system set up to track vehicle data, the data you get back is only going to be as accurate as that system. So like VIN reporting when people are making repairs and stuff, like assuming, I mean, that has to be accurate in order for the information you're getting out of it to be worthwhile. And I would suspect there's a lot of places where that falls down.
Yeah, and there is. And, you know, I've talked about this before in one of my videos, and Carfax and AutoCheck are a great place to start if you're doing research on a vehicle, because you can sometimes weed out a car just based on, well, it's had an accident, or, you know, it has like 10 owners. You know, that's mm-hmm. what you use it for typically. But, you know, like older cars, before states were reporting in crash data, or sharing their databases, or insurance companies were sharing their databases. And again, this varies state by state. You know, you may have a car pre-2005 that may have had 10 accidents, and it's not going to ever be reported in that database. So again, you have to use a lot of common sense, kind of like the Blue Book pricing. You look at it as a guide, and if there's no red flags there, then you go into the next step, which should always be some type of physical mechanical inspection on these things.
Totally. I think it's a lot like Yelp reviews, where when you read, you have to use discernment to figure out what and what's relevant to you. You know, like a restaurant that has like 2.5 stars, but people are complaining about service. I kind of don't care about service. I'm more of a food guy. Yeah. So, you know, using that, and then obviously like some sort of pre-purchase inspection. I come from, based on like my aviation background, the notion of like not having a proper pre-purchase inspection seems kind of wacky to me. So, you know, making sure you know what you're getting.
Yeah. And I think places like BAT, you know, Bring a Trailer they're getting too big, but I mean, they're revolutionizing things by the extreme side of documentation, documentation, photos, underbody shots. I mean, this is what you want going forward. If you're buying cars, you really, with all the technology that's out there, there's no excuse why somebody shouldn't have like you said, a pre-purchase inspection, photos of every nook and cranny of the car, and documentation if you want top dollar for cars, which is totally not feasible for dealerships. But private parties should be to that level. but I mean, we could go on about that forever. Lease versus buy. What's your take?
I am a guy who buys and holds forever. I'm very thoughtful in the front end. And then because I don't want to spend money on stuff that I don't need to spend money on. So I have avgas to buy and helicopter repairs. So I save money on my car stuff. So buy a car, hold on to it forever is the logical thing, I think, to do. But a lot of people don't think that way and they want to change things out. So if you're the kind of person that's going to buy and then think 3 years down the road, like, you know what, I kind of want whatever the new thing is, leasing might make more sense.
My thought is if you're going to go buy a brand new M5, you're kind of stupid because you're going to lose $40,000 in value in 4 years and it's a waste of money and nobody wants that car after it's 5 years old anyway, unless you're going to keep it until the end of time, which nobody would. Mm-hmm. So there's certain cars that you definitely would want to buy and hold on to. And I think we know exactly what kind of cars we're talking about here, like an S2000, a 370Z, or, you know, these very niche market cars that don't particularly have problems with depreciation and everything breaking on them. But anything that is remotely like luxury car stamped or anything loaded full of technology, I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole financing. You're just going to lose too much money. But I don't know. That's my take.
That makes sense to me, man. I just know that, like, I'm a really big fan of, if you are going to buy, just buy and hold on forever. If you're in the automotive space, and it's very easy to convince yourself to make a purchase that will give you a brief spike of happiness, and then that immediately fades, and then you're stuck with, paying for a car over, you know, extended period of time, financing all that money. It's like, just buy and hold, you know, make really good decisions and then stick with them.
That's a really good point. So I would agree with what you're saying, that if you know what you want and you plan on keeping it forever and you do the research, then there should be no issue buying something, even if it's ridiculously expensive, because it's that's not going to matter to you, resale or flipping it. So that's a really good point. The next question is how does Kelley Blue Book get their pricing? Is it strictly an algorithm, or is it their own human factor adjusting prices for rarer cars? As an example, an enthusiast car like an S2000 may have a value of 30 to 40% less than what it's actually worth on the real world. That's actually a really good question, because you see this all the time. You know, yeah. What the value shows on Kelley Blue Book isn't anywhere near like what it would go for in real life.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, we do take into account transaction prices, and then there's a strong human component. There's also lag in that. And then also their resources for kind of adding interpretation to the pricing information is directed, I would suspect, at high volume cars. So it would be very easy, for example, to have a specific engine variant. Let's say you've got like a Ford F-350, and it's got like the engine that doesn't suck. But, you know, that's kind of a niche thing that perhaps we might not put as much effort or resources towards behind, as opposed to like, you know, some other vehicle that's much higher volume. So I guess because there is a human component, there's potential for inaccuracies. But there's also, you know, the ability to be discerning. So anytime you have humans involved, it's going to be imperfect is what I'm saying.
Okay. But and that makes sense. And I mean, sometimes you just can't look at price guides for like one-off cars, because how do you do analytics on cars that are so small volume? You really can't make, that's something for more of like a weird pricing guide thing to do. I mean, when you're looking at transactional prices for thousands of cars, it's a lot easier to get data versus, oh, there might be like 20 cars sold the whole month, like in wholesale versus private party might be a lot more. It's not like they're going to get the transaction data from that. So it's kind of harder to formulate it.
Yeah, totally. Well, and if you have like a decisive number on here's what this thing's supposed to be worth, that really benefits from large numbers. But if you have a car and it only has 10 buyers in America, but those 10 buyers really want it, that's going to do weird things. It's going to be hard for us to account for. So especially like for like people who are listening to this, like, you know, people who are probably a little bit more enthusiast driven, you guys are gonna have a better sense of what something's worth right now than perhaps our team that's looking at like kind of the bigger picture stuff.
Yes, and that I think that's the final thing to say is if you if you're looking at that price guide, that's what the dealer is going to do to you if you go to trade it in. And like, if you say, oh, well, you know, that's exactly what they're going to give you, even though the private market is not going to give you that. So you have to use your head that these systems are not perfect for every scenario. So this is, I'm going to do three more questions because I don't want to run this into the ground with you and keep you all night.
No worries, man.
In your honest opinion, what new trends are manufacturers moving towards that the consumer should try to avoid, like CVTs, engine idle stop or engine cutoff, port or direct injections, things like that? Are there any major trends that manufacturers are trying to force that we should avoid?
Yeah, the automatic engine start stop, I mean, as highlighted there, is one where there's essentially no consumer benefit. It's just about kind of like checking fuel economy boxes for the manufacturer. There's nothing to be gained out of that. And especially, you know, how like GM was implementing systems with no ability to deactivate. It's rare that I'm offended, but I was offended by that. And the other one I'll throw out too is capacitive touch, or like a complete reliance on a touch screen. This is one of those things that I noted earlier when I was trying to make some adjustments driving that Honda Civic Type R, which even in comfort mode, it's fairly bouncy, and trying to make precise taps through the Apple CarPlay interface over a slightly bumpy road was very difficult. So I think hard dedicated buttons for logical functions supplemented by a touchscreen makes a lot of sense. But the whole everything is in the screen, I'm a little bit leery of. And yes, I know Tesla has a great interface and it's a massive screen, and they have really large actuation areas. If you've ever looked, it's like, well, that's a pretty large target if you need to hit it. So I think that's one answer. Or some cases make a really huge ass screen, but complete reliance on screens. Ugh.
I'm going to leave that question to you. I'm not even going to answer it because I think that's a whole different video that or a podcast that I would go over, but I like your answers for sure. A couple C8 questions. Does the C8 kill the 718 and Supra? If so, what do you think Porsche and Toyota's response will be? Do you think the fact that GM was able to do it in-house for a reasonable MSRP make the reasons Toyota cited for the partnering with BMW seem foolish now?
Man, I rarely have seen a car introduction that I think kind of changes everything. I literally, as I was at the C8 reveal, when they said under $60,000. Now, this might be a little bit like the Tesla. Like, I don't know how you're going to get your hands on a sub $60,000 C8, at least not in the first couple of years. But yeah, I was just driving a Supra yesterday, and I enjoyed driving the Supra, but for slightly more to get something that looks like a proper supercar, I think I know where I put my money. So I'm honestly not sure how GM developed that thing. I mean, I'm sure they cut corners in certain places, maybe the interior, but I'm not sure how they achieved that. I think it was something of a marvelous achievement. So I don't know. What do you think? How do you think Toyota and Porsche might respond?
Well, first of all, I haven't said anything about the C8. People ask me all the time, and here's really my feeling. I expected it to be $100,000. So the low price point really surprised me, but it also scares the hell out of me. I would 100% tell anybody looking for that, do not buy it. And I'd say do not buy it based on my experience and the people I've talked to's experience about working on modern GM products that come in with almost every single major component broken after like 3 years for no good reason other than just absolute, absolute cost cutting and poor design. So to have a mid-engine car to that level at $60,000, either they're severely subsidizing it and losing money, or they've cut so many corners that you're going to start seeing things like cooling problems, which they took forever to figure out on the Z06 of the last generation. Now they're stuffing an engine in the back half of the car. They've had so many developmental issues with the car. And I just don't trust that they're going to have a reliable vehicle for at least a couple years. And, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if you start seeing things like engine fires or overheating or electrical problems and all this stuff out of that car, which is why I would stay clear. I mean, what's the old adage? Like, if you build something special, you should get what it's worth out of it. Like, don't devalue your product. And I think the fact that it's so low priced is not indicative of what a mid-engine sports car to that level should be priced. I know that's totally counterintuitive because everybody wants everything cheap, but no one else has been able to make a car, a mid-engine sports car like that. Like the NSX is a perfect example. I hate the NSX, but it's $160,000+ for a properly engineered mid-engine car. And I think if you asked Honda to subsidize it down to $60,000, they would probably, you'd see people just turning into ashes, like if you told them that. I don't think Toyota or Porsche has anything to be worried about. I don't think they have to change a damn thing other than, tweaking their product line to cover the areas that the Corvette does not have. Like, what does the Corvette not have? A manual transmission. So you put a manual transmission in the Supra or the Z4, keep the manual trans in the Porsche as an option, because you'll get that 15% of people that GM is alienating over to them. I don't think they have to do anything. I think reliability is kind of my key thing with a sports car like that in the affordable price range. So we'll see. I know that
What do you think about the reliability angle on the Supra, given that it's, essentially a BMW? Do you think that reliability story still resonates among Toyota buyers?
It does. I mean, I've heard directly from the engineer when I asked him directly about reliability. He claims that it passes all of Toyota's internal testing with flying colors, and they believe strongly that this car will be absolutely reliable for the years to come. Now, that's marketing, right? I mean, I believe that's marketing. He's not going to tell you, oh, this thing's going to be a piece of shit. It's just not aligned with reality. But his reputation is on the line. He's not a marketing guy. So to say that publicly, he's I don't think he wants to see his legacy go down in flames over, that. But I personally, again, it's another car I wouldn't be as afraid of as the mid-engine Corvette based on my experience with GM products. But I would definitely sit the first year out, unless you're an early adopter, and see, what pops up with that car. But I mean, let's face it, the architecture is Klar. It's stuff they've done before. So that's, that's going to be strong. It's nothing different than BMW's putting in all their mass produced cars that are of 2019, which, are flaky sometimes, but I don't know, man.
All I know is that if until the C8 catches a fire and I have to leave it, smoldering on the side of the 5, I'm excited about driving something that if they could do it, if it's not suspiciously cheap, if they could do it, that would be a very neat thing. That's all I'm saying.
I'm hoping that it's good, but I truly believe with what I've seen that it is. There's no way that they could do it. There's just no way. I have zero faith. I would say if you had a 1 to 10 confidence level that this car is not, there's going to be problem free, I'd say I'd put it at a 1. I think it's a definite do not even touch it the first 2 years. When's the last time they did a mid-engine car, GM?
Big long pause.
That would it be the Fiero?
Oh my God, you're right.
And how? Okay, so I mean, I don't think there's anything else to be said other than that, unless you're a GM diehard and you're like, oh, my dad's worked there for 67 years. There's no way,
You know what's great, though, is that this podcast is going to be like part of the historical record. Like, if things go sideways, you're going to look so like you've got this prescient vision. You're like the Nostradamus of bad GM products.
Well, I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. Let me just put it that way. But if from a consumer focused look at it, I can't, I have to look at it kind of from the dark side. And if it's great, I hope somebody can come back to me and say, dude, you're an idiot. GM's the best. This is the best car ever made. And I'll probably own one as well. And I can come back and say I was wrong.
I sent a follow-up podcast in about 2 years' time.
Yeah, and it'll be a giant ad for Chevrolet. Like, duh. As someone who has reviewed cars for the past 10 years, did I already ask this question? Yeah, I did. Wow.
Hey. Okay,
we only have one question left.
Make it a good one.
Did he get a helicopter because he finally realized cars are an inferior form of transportation?
I mean, it's not untrue. Cars are definitely inferior, but that's not why I got a helicopter. I bought a helicopter because I literally cannot remember a time in my life when I did not want to be a helicopter pilot. Like, there's no point in my life when I was just a child that I didn't always want to fly. I can't remember a time. And so I got my license in 2008. And then about 5 years ago, we finally bought a helicopter, which was the result of years and years of savings and a ton of research and that kind of stuff, and a super supportive wife. But I will say that, you know, my enthusiasm for the automobile as just sort of a pure pleasure device has faded a little bit. The helicopter kind of reframes things. So, by the way, let me do this. So I do this every once in a while if people are interested, but I don't want to be forceful. Mark, if you ever want to go fly in the helicopter, you let me know. And the beautiful thing about owning a helicopter is you can fly whenever you want. So text me, let me know when you want to go fly, and we can go. But I'm not going to bother you. I'm not going to hound you about going flying. So the offer is open. It's a real offer. Come fly with me, man.
I want to experience it. I definitely do. I think it's amazing. When you told me, I think I don't remember what event we kind of were mingling at when I met you. Do you remember what car that was?
Kia Soul.
Okay. So I showed up at this like checkpoint where he was eating, and he was sitting there quietly looking like a good boy eating his food. And I said, "Hey, I know who you are. You're that guy from Kelly Blue Book. You're one of my favorites." And he autographed my lower back, and we got to talking, and he's like, "I flew in, you know, to the whatever, some area, wherever the restaurant was, in my helicopter." And, you know, like, I didn't know anything about this guy. I really didn't know about you. I knew of you watching your videos. But when you said you flew on your helicopter, that's something I often tell people as a joke, that I got there via helicopter. And when I found out for real that you actually flew in on a fucking helicopter, I'm like, who is this guy? This guy's a god. I'm like, I'm going to clone his life and become him and take over. So it's so cool, man. It definitely is. And you have zero douchebag factor. Like, I love the fact that you're like still normal and like a humble guy, like that you're not trying to be like flashy or flexing on people either. So
Yeah, man, that, you know what it is? It's because I started as a janitor, and I think at any moment I could go back. at some point, they're going to discover I'm a fraud, and I'm going to have to go back to janitoring, which, by the way, is a fine job. I'm pretty wicked putting the trash bags in the trash cans with, like, a nice tight seal. But, yeah, all things being equal, I'd rather, you know, stay here doing what I'm doing. So, yeah, come join me doing the helicopter thing. L.A., by helicopter is the best. So yeah, like next time you're in LA, just let me know and we'll go fly. And then maybe we should do a video. Should we do like a helicopter video or something?
I would definitely want to do a video about the helicopter. I know you've already done a video about that. I don't know what the hell I'm gonna do about it besides just be like, whoa, you know, like
no, you know what, you would have a unique take. You would notice things that I haven't noticed about it. I mean, I really know that helicopter, but you would dig it. There's some mechanical peculiarities that I think you'd really appreciate. So let's do that, man. Let's do it. Come on out here.
You're gonna regret inviting me, because once I start seeing this thing and dig into it, I'm gonna be asking you like for 3 hours, well, what does this toggle do, and why is this oil line run or hydraulic line run here, and like, get this guy out of here.
I would love to do that. I would love nothing more than to endure a barrage of questions from you.
All right. Well, let's close it at that before we get in any real fights here on the internet. thank you so much for coming on. You're technically the very first official guest.
What?
Yeah.
Oh man, I take that as a major honor. And by the way, what you do on YouTube, but I love that you're expanding into the podcast world. So let me just give you a big virtual high five. High five.
Oh, I got it. But there's some lag there. Can you fix, there's too much latency. Can you fix your internet connection?
we'll get it in post.
Okay, good. All right. Thanks everybody for listening to this podcast. Obviously, if you want to support it and support Micah's channel, go and support it by hitting the subscribe button on there. And, you know, he's going to get so big that he's just going to be rolling in gold chains and